Welcome to RAQA Today, the podcast that puts the fun back in quality, compliance, and regulatory affairs. Here's your host, Michelle Lott.
So, hi, I'm Michelle with Lean RAQA, and I'm here with my friend Shauna Monterey from Beanstalk Ventures. And we're going to talk to you a little bit today about the way Beanstalk tackles the software space from about three different angles. So the first one that I think connected us right away was your third-party review designation. But then once I got to know you, there are two other sides to Beanstalk as well that I think people need to know about. So tell us a little bit about all those.
Sure. So we have FDA accreditation. So we're 1 in 9 globally accredited by the FDA. What that means is we can review and approve select class 2 devices on behalf of the FDA, and we do about 250 product codes. As part of that, we provide regulatory consulting. So we used to do a lot of software and instrumentation product development. We kind of switched to just really focus on the regulatory side of things. And so when we look at a consulting engagement, we help define regulatory strategy, which includes regulatory pathway. We help a lot on the technical side of things. So we help a lot on the what's called the design history file, which is the technical part of the submission. And we help our clients kind of move through that process in hopes of fast-tracking their clearance. We also have a community platform, which is called a grassroots. It's basically enabling digital health developers in terms of networking and getting training and templates. And so it's a free community. We have curated data specific to the digital community. And also we have paid services as well. So that's something that we're growing and we get new users all the time. So that's really exciting for us. And then the other offering we have is a fast track software solution to get your clinical diagnostic software into the hands of your clinician. And also it's provided basically a front end user interface. It's significantly cheaper than developing something yourself. It's under a quality management system. It's regulatory grade, which means it can be easily cleared, and we maintain and we worry about cyber and all that kind of stuff. So those are kind of the three offerings that we have from a consulting and product development perspective. Mm-hmm.
Now, what came first for you? Was it the accreditation or the consulting?
It was the consulting, but what ended up happening is way back when I started the company, it's called Beanstalk Ventures, my plan was to build basically an incubator. So what I wanted to do is take all my expertise on how to build products, because I'm very efficient at doing that, taking my model, scaling it, and helping other startups get to market faster. And what ended up happening once I put that intent out there, I started getting a lot of inquiries from people I worked with before asking me if I can build their product. And so when I left my career at Illumina, I had like 6 customers wanting me to build their medical product on the software side. So then consulting kind of came first. Then when COVID hit, we decided to readjust, right, where we put our money. So we had like some money left from the consulting side of the business, and we decided to invest in the three areas that I mentioned. So the accreditation, the grassroots platform, the digital health learning and training community, and then Bedrock, which is our sample to answer analytical platform. So we invested in all three at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That was truly a three-legged stool there that you're building.
Exactly. And then we went back now to realize, okay, what we've developed now is a venture studio. So we do have our venture studio. And the next step for us as Beanstalk Ventures is we're going to be fundraising for a fund. And then we're going to use our framework to incubate companies. And that's mm-hmm. our plan. And we want to focus on companies that have kind of complex diagnostics, which includes analytics analysis, either AI-based or some other statistical analysis framework.
Well, I thought that that was one thing that was really cool once you and I got to know each other, is that you really have done the work and you were already kind of on the front end of knowing how the work needs to be done, what the FDA needs to see out of it in a submission. And then, you know, obviously you guys can't do the consulting and then do the review, but because you know what you're more efficient at the review because you have done the work before. And you didn't just read the guidance document about what goes in a 510K with software or cybersecurity. So, you know, this is something else we've talked about is that third-party reviewers typically don't have some of the best reputations or experiences, you know, in industry, and they definitely don't save people as much time as they think. But I think that that's the difference with somebody that has actually done the work and knows what to expect out of it than somebody that has just been, you know, been through the training and whatnot
Exactly.
that you need to do for the accreditation.
Exactly. And we have a lot of deep technical expertise as well, right? The submissions are quite technical. And so, because we've done software on instrumentation and software in the cloud, including AI and diagnostics, automation, all those things, we understand the fundamentals around the technology and where the gaps might be. And when we do the review, we're focused on those elements. We're focused on the high-risk elements, right? There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done, a lot of things you need to do to include in your submission. But at the end of the day, when you're doing 510K, you're looking to show substantial equivalency. Someone's already proven efficacy, right? And you also need to be able to show that your product is safe. And then now we have the aspect of cybersecurity, which includes safety and data privacy. So those are kind of the lenses that we're looking at it from. Even though submission may be complete, if it's lacking depth in those areas, that's going to be problematic. And that's where I think we provide value to do that level of review before it goes to the FDA. And so our whole goal is when we're doing the third party review is that we don't get any feedback from the FDA. And if we do, we can defend our recommendation on behalf of our client. So we don't actually have to go back and forth. And we've been successful in being able to do that.
Talk to us a little bit about what the expectations that industry should have out of third-party reviewers in terms of review times and experiences, and then how to choose the right partner if you do want to do the third-party review.
So the review times are about the fastest we've seen, at least recorded by the FDA, is 54 days, and the longest is about three months or so. When you submit to a third party, you still are going to get feedback just like you would with the FDA. I think the difference is the back and forth is dependent upon the third party review organization. It's not limited to one interaction, right? Where the FDA limits the back and forth interaction that you have. The same thing applies when you're submitting to the FDA. When you submit to third party, is making sure your submission's complete, right? Don't use the third party as a filter to kind of see how good you are. Hire a consultant to do an audit of your submission before you actually submit, because you don't want to waste time, right? You want to make sure that it is complete and you put your best foot forward. In terms of like overall start to finish time, it's about 130 days or so, something like that. It's about 3 months. FDA does still have the final say. And so even though you submit it to a third party, we then do the review on behalf of the FDA instead of FDA doing it. And then we're providing the recommendation to the FDA. So it's really important that we have all the data that we need from our clients to actually say, yes, you know, we believe that they're substantial equivalent. Here's the information. This is why I believe so. This is what's been provided to me to make that judgment call. And then what we want at the end of the day is FDA to adhere to or agree with what we've said. And then FDA guarantees about 30 days to respond on the actual recommendation. And so far, they're pretty good. They're about 25 days or so. So they've been adhering to that. So it's pretty quick. It is quicker and more efficient, I would say, than going direct to the FDA.
And then what do people need to know about picking the right partner?
Gosh, I would say domain expertise is important. Not so much that they've done them before, but they actually understand the guidances and any sort of consensus standards around your product code. And then also that they have then the technical expertise as well, because it goes both. It's not just the regulation there. They actually need to understand the technology. And so that's going to be really important. And so if they don't have direct technology, you want something parallel, right? Like you wouldn't want to submit your third party with an AI component to a third party reviewer that doesn't have AI experience, for example, right? Maybe they have glucose monitoring experience and that's what you're submitting, but you have an AI element on top. You want to make sure they have both of those things, something comparable. So that's really important. The other piece is just understanding what to expect. What's the engagement model, right, going to be with a third party and how they're actually going to work with you and what kind of engagement are you interested in, right? Do you want something that's more interactive or more kind of a black box? Because I think, the FDA doesn't restrict us on how we actually interact with the client. We obviously can't provide consulting, right? But we can meet with them more often if we need to kind of explain what we're looking for and the gaps there.
So I'd imagine that that is part of that time savings that people sometimes realize with the third party reviewers is just the speed and frequency at which, and probably the, I don't want to say lack of formality, but you don't have to put something necessarily on the letterhead, and you can take a phone call and stuff and be a little bit more
Exactly.
communicative.
Exactly. And we've offered to take a phone call when we provide our first feedback. And what we like to do sometimes as well to speed things up is we don't wait to the end to give all the feedbacks. And we'll say, okay, we finished this part, right? Like, for example, let's say it's a software submission. We're like, okay, we looked at your design file, the next, and your labeling. Here's the feedback so far. Now we're going to dig into cyber and we might have more findings, right? So we can stage it that way so that they can get the feedback iteratively so they don't have to wait at the end. And we usually do it in two pieces. I'll usually spend upfront review and then I'm like, okay, I kind of see what's lacking. Let me send that to them so they can work on that while I finish the second half of the review.
So recently I saw this new guidance document come out from the FDA at the end of last year about the EUAs, particularly around the IVD space. And I believe you guys are in that space as well, because that's getting more and more software driven on the analysis. What was that guidance all about? What is it planning on changing or bringing to third-party reviews that may or may not exist now? And where are you guys at in the IVD space?
Yeah, so with COVID, there was like an influx of emergency use, right? The COVID test, and then there were some other tests. I don't know if it was monkeypox, there was some other disease that came up, and then the ventilators, right? And so FDA had an influx of emergency use authorization requests, and they couldn't keep up. And so the idea is now is that they're going to open it up to third-party reviewers so that we can take then the backlog, right? So if there's a significant amount of submissions or if there's, God forbid, another pandemic or something, then we can take those and process them so they can go faster. In light of the new regulation, or it's a proposed, I don't think it's actually gone through yet, but there's a proposal for regulating LDTs as IVDs and IVDs as devices, which means, if you're an LDT, you're a medical device. If you're an IVD, you're basically a medical device, and FDA expects to regulate those. They are also going to open those up to third parties. There's a few product codes that are relevant today that we can clear on third party. That are traditionally IVDs. They're not necessarily specific to IVDs, but IVDs have cleared under those product codes. They plan on opening up more of those, and then that'll help the backlog as well. And so that'll be a good opportunity for us to look at those. From our business perspective, we're probably about, I don't know, probably it depends on the year, but we'll do between 40 to 60% IVDs. Because we have the experience and a lot of it's analytical heavy, a lot of it's software.
How's the FDA going to get the third parties review ready to review EUAs for either types of tests or technologies that might not have? Are they going to have, like, I don't want to say a checklist, but are they going to come up with the standard level of what they expect in a submission and quality of data and et cetera, and give you guys kind of a protocol to follow? Or do
I'm
you have
not
any idea?
sure, actually. I would expect something would come out, but probably not as fast enough, right? Usually, what ends up happening is it'll open it up and then we'll start moving along and then we'll find gaps and then we'll see the guidance kind of come out shortly after. So I'm assuming there'll be some guidance around it. We would have to probably qualify, right? So for example, for the IVD codes, we'd have to then go and recertify for those codes. So when we get our accreditation, we have to, one, be accredited, but two, we have to actually be accredited for the codes that we select. And so it's probably going to open up, and then we have to show the FDA evidence that we're actually qualified to do those reviews. I would say that would probably be the first step.
And some continued competency there.
and probably some oversight. So FDA is not really, they're not hands-off on the third-party program. We're supposed to interface with the FDA early and often when we do a third-party review. And that's something that's important. You ask, like, how do you, you know, vet a third-party review organization is also making sure that they are meeting with the FDA and asking the FDA very specific questions that could cause some concerns when we give our recommendation, right? If we ask really good questions up front to say, okay, client I have, they're planning on showing substantial equivalency like this, they have a predicate, there's a difference in technology, right? They're justifying it this way. Is that appropriate? Yes or no, right? Then we can gain confidence and we don't have to wait to the end. So you do want a third-party review that actually is active and does consult with the FDA because it's supposed to be interactive. And so I would imagine like the EUAs and the LDTs and stuff, they would have some level of interaction as well because they're not trying to be hands-off. They want to make sure that we provide equivalent reviews. And that's why it's unfortunate that the third-party reviewer is getting a bad reputation because we're supposed to be equivalent to the FDA and it's supposed to provide value. And if that's not happening, that's unfortunate.
And I think that that's interesting because you guys then are allowed to talk to the FDA up front when you get a new project or a new submission turned into you. It's not like you work in a bubble or you should not be working necessarily in a bubble during that process. So, you know, and I think that that was some learning for me during talking to you is that now, you know, I think most people know that the third party review has to be listed on the product code that they are going to review. But the point you made was not only do you want them to obviously be on that product code, but you want to know what their real experience with each component and facet of your technology is, not just that they are accredited to review it per se.
Exactly. I mean, you can have a product code that's instrument plus software, but you can also use that product code for software only, right? And if you're going to a third-party reviewer that's not a software expert in that case, and that's going to potentially be problematic because that's the lens they need to look at your submission. It's not just electromechanics anymore, right? It's a different type of submission. It looks very different.
So
stability for software versus software and instruments quite, you know, it could be quite different. Labeling's quite different, right? There's other areas.
Right. And any type of AI algorithms throwing in a whole other ball
yes.
of wax.
Yeah, exactly.
So we talked briefly about the what to expect with the LDTs. Is the FDA going to get third parties involved with the LDTs or are they going to keep that to themselves and maybe open up more IVDs? Because the LDTs right now, it's beyond the wild, wild west. You know, it's...
Well, the definition now is if you're an LDT, you're an IVD. And if you're an IVD, you're a device. That's what the proposed rule says. And so there's no distinction between them. So if people are developing LDTs, what is going to happen, this is what I'm guessing just by following along, is that the CLIA will still be required, right? So if you're processing an IVD now, which used to be an LDT, you still have CLIA oversight, just like you would have GMP for manufacturing. Right. So if you look at kind of like assume some equivalency there that if you're building a medical device, right, manufacturing one, you have GMP. And if you're processing a sample under an IVD, you're under like, you know, CLIA. And so the gap is that the LDTs weren't developed under design control, basically. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what FDA is looking for. Like, is this product safe and effective? Right. There's no oversight of the performance of those tests. There's no vigilant reporting, right? There's a lot of things that happen and those tests can actually change quite frequently without going back again through that whole process. And so the CLIA part is just the lab validation piece, right? It's looking at the actual production of the actual result itself, where then the IVD is going to be around the actual, you know, design controls and the actual clearance of the diagnostic itself or the IVD, whatever the IVD is actually for. So FDA did say in the proposed rule that they will open these up third-party reviewers and even mentioned that they may even open up the application period for additional third-party reviewers that have more lab background or more specificity around those type, more experience around those type of tests so that they can get more qualified reviewers. And I know, I think to date, there's at least one third-party reviewer that I know that actually has a CLIA lab, like that's their other part of the business, and then they do the third-party reviews. So it'd be perfect for them. For us, it's great because we do the analytics side of software and we've done plenty of IVDs, companion diagnostics and all of that, like to support PMAs and whatnot. So for us, it's great because it gives us the opportunity to support the industry. And our goal would be to get the IVDs or the LDTs cleared, I would say in less than 6 months. And that's what we're trying to build. So with our offerings, we're trying to position it or package it in such a way that we can get the LDTs through pretty quick.
So from the consulting perspective, what are some of the most common mistakes that you are seeing people make either in the submissions they're turning into you or making as they're trying to develop their regulatory documentation?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of stuff that you preach, right? Like come to us and they're like, I'm going to submit next week. And we're like, where's your design history file? What's that? So like 6 months before submission without doing the actual design work and the testing is usually too late, right? So it can generally take anywhere from, depending on the complexity, let's say, of the product, like sometimes we could see it could take, you know, up to 24 months. Mm-hmm. So it just depends. And so clients come to us really late. The other thing they'll do is they'll try to do it themselves. So they'll do an FDA submission without experience. It'll be their first one. So they don't have anyone in the company that's done it before and they're not consulting with anyone. So generally you'll see a lot of rejections from the FDA in that regard. I wouldn't say rejections, right? But there'll be a lot of findings that they're not able to satisfy within the timeframe required by the FDA. My favorite
one on that note is I had a client come to me and say, Michelle, we've got a product now. We're ready for you to write our 510K. And I'm like, great. Give me your software requirements. Give me. And I started, you know, rattling off some of the very basic software documentation. And they're like, oh, we don't have any documentation. And I'm like, well, then you don't really have a product as far as the FDA goes. And yeah, they had a completely unrealistic time frame for when they thought they wanted their 510K cleared. And so it was trying to go from, you know, zero on any kind of documentation that you need to put in a submission to a 510K and nothing flat. And just, it didn't. It was
the remediation. We've remediated the most simplest product that I can think of that basically had no design history file. It took us 6 months. Yeah, just to remediate. I mean, we had to include testing as well, but still, it took us a while. And that's not including usability. The company we worked for doing that submission decided to do usability a little bit later, so they submitted without that. But yeah, it takes a while. It's a lot of work and it's expensive after the fact because that knowledge is all lost and you still need to go back and understand it because you need to understand the risk and the safety and was it fully tested and other aspects of the design need to be considered. But then I think there's other cases too, where, you know, our clients are ready for a third party and they don't know their intended use statement, their product code or their description, right? So then we're like, okay, you know, and sometimes the intended use is quite different. Like it's not even the same disease type and it's completely different user, like one's women's health and then the other one's like diabetes or something, right?
Which people, by the way, that means different review divisions in the FDA, which means different 510Ks, you know, you're not going to just get the kitchen sink cleared.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's a different lens to look at it because they are looking at the specifics, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's under a different organization within FDA, which means a set of reviewers. And separate standards are different, right? The special controls are different. So it's just not having that and thinking, you know, you're ready to go is usually the one we see a lot. Like not having any documentation or anything. We see that a lot. I think Companies that are raising money, we've seen that, right? They're raising money, but they don't have a regulatory strategy. And like, good luck getting an investor to sign on if you don't understand how much it's going to cost you and how you're going to actually clear it. So that's a big gap as well.
I think people are really underestimating the savviness of the average life science investor now. I think that they're more educated about the regulatory requirements than they used to be. And, you know, whether that is that they actually, you know, went to seminars and got educated by their different angel organizations, or that they've been burned in the past, you know, that and I see people telling their investors all kinds of, you know, off the wall stuff, doing their own research or whatever, and investors are starting to poke holes in their regulatory strategy.
They are. I mean, I was asked by a VC a couple of weeks ago when I was at JP Morgan why regulatory consultants don't align, the business strategy with the regulatory strategy, right? And I was talking about like that's just inherent in what we do. And a lot of times our clients don't understand that, but it's very integrated, right? If your business strategy is you're going to launch in Europe and then Japan and then US or whatever, you're going to have a global launch, that's very different than just launching, to the US. And if you have a base technology that you plan on having multiple indications, like that's a very different, strategy. And it's real important to align the business model with the regulatory strategy. And then there was another comment by one of the VCs I was talking to around whether or not you have to take what FDA says at face value. Like FDA is like, I need to increase your study by, 500 participants. And you're like, okay, then I'm going to go do what FDA says. That can be challenged as well. And I brought that up. I'm like, just because FDA recommends this, they don't know about your product in a lot of cases as much as you do, right? Where you can go back and justify this is why it doesn't matter, or this is how we're going to collect data in the future, or we're going to have a slow rollout. Like there's things that can still be discussed and back and forth. You don't necessarily have to take a recommendation on face value. Like you can challenge it with data, right? And
Right.
come and
But there
talk.
has to be data. There has to be a statistical justification.
Yeah, you have to justify it intelligently to where they can actually then verify your justification for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And not just, well, it's obvious that everybody I've talked to that picks the number 100 out of the air as being the random statistically significant number with no justification plan or
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, that's what we get asked a lot. What's our sample size? I'm like, you have to do it based on your intended user, right? Your technology, your population, right? You have to make sure that your sample size is statistically significant. It's not the opposite, like let me pick 100 because that's, it might not be statistically significant for your actual product to prove what you need to prove, right? And I said, it depends what you're testing,
We're
right?
going to pick 100 because we can afford it, and then we're going to back our way down the statistical justification for it.
Yeah, we see that as well. But I think in terms of trends, what we're seeing is I don't think this is a new trend, but this is what we see a lot. And I think we see it a lot with startups, is that the depth of the testing is FDA will use the word superficial. They'll say the testing appears to be superficial. And what we'll see is that the software requirements are very high level. Like the software, I don't know, give you an example, allows the user to log in, right? But it has no specificity around if there's any timeouts, the password constraints, right? Do they have two-factor authentication, any sort of encryption, like all that's missing. And so then the testing will just be I tested, I logged in, logged out, and it worked, right? And so that's very superficial. And superficial testing, I think, is fine around the areas of the software that aren't clinical, right? That don't impact the safety or the performance of the product or cyber, right? But once you get around that, then those are the areas where you're focusing. You need to show that it's been well tested. And in order to well test it, it has to be well specified, right? And so we'll see issues at the spec level. That's one. The other one, which is not my favorite, but I guess it's like it's obvious, it's a cyber, right? Cyber keeps coming back. And one thing that I hope changes is the way the cyber guidance is written. It doesn't allow for a variation based on your software risk, right? So when you do your submission, your software has two categories now. It's either basic or enhanced, and it's called documentation level. It used to be called level concern, right? So you could have a very basic submission for class two product, the minimal amount of documentation. And then you go look at cyber and it's like everything under the sun and there's no negotiation point there. And FDA's been kind of really per the guidance on that one, right? So everything I've seen, it's like you don't have this, and this. And so there's nothing in the guidance that right size it for a lower risk device. And I'd like to see that in the future. And I think it's unfortunate because you can see a disparity with the work that's being done on the cyber. Right. Even the risk is extremely low for their product versus the rigor that's being done around the actual analytic part of the or the diagnostic part of the device or clinical decision support or whatever. So you'll see kind of a disparity there, right? You'll see a submission like this on cyber and the rest is like this, where really I would expect the actual product itself. Kind of like what we saw when people were validating tools like crazy, like development tools, they were over-validating, but they weren't validating their device as well. So that's kind of what I'm seeing. And then like another area of the AI piece, which is their statistical data. That's a big one.
I think cybersecurity is the next area of regulatory grief for people, because those are those expectations went from very loosely defined to like very rigorous. To the industry, it's going to feel like almost overnight. They came out with a regulation and a guidance and and a webinar and everything all together, all at one time, about mid-year last year. And so a lot of people haven't been through that whole process in the 510K with the FDA to see, okay, this is what they say. These are what the expectations are around it. And they're not, like you said, they're not having that the kind of bar is the same height regardless of.
Of the product, yeah, regardless of the risk. And it is quite rigorous. And so far, there's no room for negotiation as far as I can see. And when I look at the guidances, I'm actually quite surprised how rigorous and how technical it is compared to the other software guidances. It's very different. So I don't know if that's a new trend or if it's just inconsistent with what we're used to seeing, because it is well specced out and there's a high level of specificity. But with that said, if you look at like what came from the US government, they were very specific. They literally called out, you need an SBOM, which I thought was very unusual to have an SBOM in law, right? And you're seeing now with AI, they're following suit. The IVD regulation, the CFR for that isn't quite, the proposed ruling isn't quite that specific. It's still at a high level, just at the definition to say LDT, IVD, hence is a device and we regulate it as such. But the cyber was very specific, like all software products will have an SBOM, right? And the SBOM will be machine readable, like very specific in the law, which is unusual.
So, like, if you look at the consistency, just I guess at the universal level of how FDA is regulating different products and product types versus maybe different technologies and technology features, we've got a little of a disconnect where they're going super deep and maybe even more deep and specific than they need to be. Whereas, we've taken LDTs that have almost not been regulated and just throwing them on. Into another generic bucket where they don't understand the world of which they are now operating in, and we don't have enough articulation around that.
That's a really good point because the LDTs won't, because there's no specific guidance for the IVDs, right? There's very few, and when there are, I think there are a couple, but they're very specific to a type of IVD and a specific disease type or specific technology. So they're just not there. So when they need to clear, where do they start, right? And they haven't been in this space, so they're kind of clueless, and you can't navigate easily, no matter how much the FDA's try to harmonize their website and they've done a good job, you can't harmonize the subjectivity of being able to find stuff. There's still a lot of subjectivity to it. Finding your product code, like it's like do a research and figure it out and find something similar, right? It's not specific enough for people that just say, okay, this is my roadmap. This is what I need to do to convert my LDT to an IVD. You're right. It doesn't have that. There's that level of specificity doesn't exist. But oh, wait, if I have a, digital part of my product, it doesn't matter if it's firmware or whatever, and I have the potential of connecting, here's a whole slew of things that I need to do, right? And it's like, to your point, I agree, it's very rigorous. It's different. It's unusual to see that.
Well, do you have any last thoughts to close us out here?
No, I think we're good. I think, well, I guess, yeah, I will have some last thoughts. What I expect to see is basically in the future is harmonization. And I hope to see that because you see guidances and standards coming out all over. They all say the same thing, but slightly different. And there's nuances. And it's a lot of rigor for us, even as consultants, to figure out what's there and what's applicable and harmonizing stuff, right? We have to do that review by review. And it's a lot of waste. So I hope to see a trend more towards more recognized consensus standards and that type of thing so that people can comply more easily.
Yeah, that's a great term, review by review.
Exactly.
Yeah, so the more regulations there are, the more complexity there is to understanding them and piecing together what is and is not required.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, for us as consultants, we can say, oh, this is good. This is why we're in business, but not really. It's hard to convince our clients of that and how much time it takes us to really delve into something and understand it and apply it specific to a nuance or something, right? It takes us time, and a lot of clients don't understand the value of that, right? And the time and the effort that it takes. So I think, there can be some improvements there to help both sides, our customers and us as consultants.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join me. This has been a great conversation. And you guys see, Shauna does a lot of different things across your whole product life cycle. So give her a call if she can be helpful in the development or the clearance of your software as a medical device, AI, cybersecurity involved product.